ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to the music show on ABC Radio National, coming to you from Gundungurra country. I'm Andrew Ford. In 1929, Arlen Weeks wrote in the Scientific Monthly, "Ships become obsolete, fine furs are ravaged by moths, faded by the sun, worn by rubbing against showcases, garments go out of style, the gold watch grandfather handed down is replaced by a thin one. Change and decay is all around, except in violins. Death rarely comes to the violin." From the Baroque to the Romantic to the Rustic to the Contemporary, today's music show is a sort of biography of the violin in Australia from 1788 to 1914 and beyond. Dr. Laura Case is our expert and also our fiddler today. She's a lecturer in musicology at the Sydney Conservatorium, and she's one of Radio National's Arts Top Five. She's going to introduce us to some of the historical characters who've carried the instrument through those years and some of the places they did it, pubs and parlours, and eventually concert halls. Laura, maybe you can start by telling us how you first encountered a violin.
I started playing the violin when I was about three. I saw the violin being played on Sesame Street and I begged my parents for one. Now, it speaks to the fact that no one in my family plays music, the fact that they got me a violin and thought that would be a way to make me a bit quieter, because I was quite an extreme child, and they thought, oh, maybe this will help her calm down. It did, actually, and I've just really loved it ever since. I'm from a rural background, so I grew up in the country and I have had a lot of teachers, but the violin is just something I've always really, really loved. So I played all the way through high school, and I started a Bachelor of Performance at UNSW, majoring in, you know, violin playing, but pretty quickly realised, you know, I also really enjoy this research, and I could combine my two loves of the violin with researching lots of different things about the violin. So for my honours, I looked at kind of a psychoanalysis of how we think about violins and select violins. And then when it came to my PhD, I really wanted to look a little closer to home. And so that's what led me to look at violins and violinists, I should say, in Australia. And that's what led me to this project. And I went into the project with very few sort of, this is what I expect to get out, or this is what I want to look for. I went in very organically and was like, well, I'm just going to start looking for Australian violinists and see what that tells me. And so it was a big project, kind of massive if you're thinking of looking at violinists from 1788 till today. So that's why I ended up capping the project at 1914.
Okay. Right.
Otherwise, it would have just been too much.
Yes, fair enough. Well, and there's another project there, should
yes,
you ever wish
right.
to do it. The fact that the violin is also a fiddle, I mean, in a way, is perhaps the clue to what you're doing, that it is as high-end as you want, but it's also the exact same instrument can be
and
played in a pub.
I think that's what I really loved about this project as well, is I'm not just looking at concert violinists. I'm looking at you know, the working class and the people who were actually using the violin as a means of survival. You know, the violin was their way of earning income, and they were fiddling at pubs. They were often supplementing their income, so sometimes they were labourers and things as well. And so that's what I really liked, is you've got this broad spectrum of all different kinds of people playing the violin, and I think that is so exciting. You know, some people said, oh, you can't talk about the violin and the fiddle in the same thesis because this is a different conversation. But I thought, no, I think it's the same conversation. And I love that it can be used in all these different ways.
Yes, yes. It's obviously incredibly versatile. Mm. We're going to hear about some people during the course of this conversation, some characters. How did you discover them? Is this simply sitting, poring over books and articles and letters? And
yeah, a lot of it was. So I started off just reading old newspapers. So I went right back. There's not a lot in secondary literature on this sort of period of Australia's colonial history. There's not a lot on specific violinists from that sort of period. So mainly I've gone through primary sources, lots of newspaper articles. I've really pored over them for many, many, many hours in archives.
What are you looking for? Well, how do you research it?
I'm literally using keyword searches. So literally just the word violin and putting on a date bracket and then trying to look for everything I can in that period to just see what emerges. So it really was very organic, just seeing what comes out of that. And then I started to catalogue all of these things. And that's when, you know, I started to generate graphs. And this is the non-interesting part of my research. But the graphs helped some of these themes kind of come to light. And I was like, oh, okay, I didn't realise I'd catalogued that many things where I've put it into this category, and then this has come out. And of course, yes, I looked at old diaries, journals, letters, all these kinds of things are very rich and fruitful forms of evidence, but it's more limited. So of course, relying so heavily on newspapers, you know, that's also limiting. So there's lots of limits placed on doing, you know, historical research of this period, but you know, there are some real characters and some real stories that emerged. It was a really fun project.
Well, maybe we should talk about your first type.
Yes,
violin
great.
Type. The amateur gentleman violinist.
Yeah.
In Australia from the moment of the first fleet?
Yeah, pretty much. So the generals and the governors were often playing the violin. And this is because it was part of a well-rounded education was learning music. And the violin, particularly for men, was seen as a sign of social accomplishment. And particularly if you weren't using it as your form of livelihood, you know, that kind of represented excess leisure time. And so that was kind of the ideal way to be, you know, for a man to be playing it, is how it's kind of, you know, documented. And so, yes.
So I can play the violin, but I don't have to.
Exactly, exactly. That is this kind of man.
Yeah.
And yes, they are almost exclusively men in the period I'm looking at, but we'll get to that a little bit later.
I've been reading Pepys a bit recently, and he has a violin, and he takes when he leaves the house, he takes the violin with him, and when he visits people and he expects to be asked to play at some
yes.
point.
Yes.
So there's that kind of, as that element of expectation is a part of this, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And yeah, so like, you know, a really well-known sort of example of this kind of gentleman is Governor John Hunter. So he was the second governor after Arthur Phillip. And, you know, there's plenty of records of him just, you know, whipping his violin out to play at balls and that kind of thing. And that, you know, this long descriptions of frivolities, you know, from it would be published and or in diaries and letters and things as well. But they would talk about in such detail the tables, the way the tables were laid out, what the curtains looked like. So you've got lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of information about this kind of playing. And Governor Hunter was one of the people who would kind of whip his violin out and have a little bit of a play, and they'd say, oh, what a lovely gentleman he is.
And do we know what he played?
Yeah, so largely at this sort of time, we're not thinking like high classical music as we understand it today. It's kind of more like sentimental airs, ballads, glees, parlour songs, basically. So people used to like to, you know, of this, it was a very small circle of gentry in the colony, you know, particularly the early colony where we're thinking about at this period of time. So kind of pre-1850, it was very small, the circles of gentry. And so they would often, you know, think of the parlour, people are gathered round, they're singing, you know, songs that are sentimental, reminding them of home. And so the violin was a link to home in a lot of ways for these people, because that's how they used music. And so it was very sentimental.
And the instruments themselves obviously had come with them.
Yes. Yeah. So they brought instruments over on the ships. And yeah, there's also quite early records of just general stores selling things like violins. So that, again, like this project could totally blow out if I start to think of every single type of person who interacts with a violin that I could document. But there are a lot of, you know, kind of sellers as well at this time. So we're looking at broad periods of history. But as things started to arrive in the colonies, violins were certainly included in that.
And it wasn't just governors, was it? I mean, there's a convict as well.
Yes, he is one of my favourite stories, actually. His name is John Grant, and there's been a bit of writing about him. But he was, you know, one of these well-to-do sort of gentlemen in England. And he got accused of, I think he tried to fight someone who interfered with his bid to marry a lady. And so he got charged and he was sent to Australia. And so he came over as a convict, but he's interesting because most of the convicts were from a lower working class background, but he wasn't. And so both his combination of background and the fact that he could play the violin kind of gave him this special status. And so he would often be invited into the governor's, you know, cabin to play on the ship over, for instance. And also in the colony, he would be invited to come and play. So he had this kind of special convict status. But he also, you know, and again, I think this is a reflection of his background. He had a diary and a journal and he wrote extensively. And he would write about his thoughts and his feelings and how the violin fit into that. And so there's lots of really nice quotes about how, you know, he was sailing down the river and he played his violin as a way to kind of understand what he was seeing and make sense of things. And so that's like a really rare insight to this period. But yes, I think he's a really fascinating example.
Yes, he is. But he's using his violin and his ability to play it as a badge of,
yes,
of status, isn't
it? Yes,
he?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he was writing, like, apparently he also came over with a harpsichord box and he came over with two violins as well. So not all convicts were able to do that, right?
I was going to say.
Exactly. So right off the bat, he's being given special treatment.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of letters. So not only did he write diaries and journals, he also wrote a lot of letters back to England. And once he was released, he did go back to England. And so we have just a lot of documentation around him. Although once he goes back to England, there's not as much. But he stands out because he's interesting at this time.
Fiddlers? What about people who are actually playing to earn a living?
Yeah. There's been some really interesting research, so I can't say that I did this, but I read the person's report who did this, that he actually accessed some of the original muster reports from people who were either convicts or, you know, working on wealthy landowners and helping out as labourers. And they would write down their occupation and he went right through the muster reports and found a number of fiddlers. So we're talking like pre-1809 at this point, so very early. But the fiddlers, yeah, they're a rowdy bunch. My main form of evidence for that chapter that I wrote on fiddlers was actually arrest reports. And so the way that I found all these reports was I would just type in fiddle, basically, in the archives, and then I would put on my dates and just see what came up, and they were constantly being arrested. And I found it really interesting to compare the arrest reports of a fiddler who was being lashed for playing the fiddle after 9 p.m., for instance, because some places had strict rules about not making music after 9 p.m., but then you read the reports of the governors having this merry old time at Government House, and they were making music until 2 a.m. in the morning, and that's totally fine.
But they were playing violins,
that's
not fiddles.
Right, exactly. So I love this kind of double standard. I think it's very interesting. But the fiddlers, there was lots of fiddlers at this time as well.
And, and it's interesting, isn't it, that you can use these keywords, violin or fiddle, and you immediately go to a different class.
Yes. Yeah, and again, I guess, like subconsciously, I probably expected that to happen, but I didn't realize how clear that distinction would be. Like, it seriously was very clear going through this. Like, I guess people understood where they fit into this structure by the type of music they're listening to and the way they engage. And, you know, so it was really interesting. And most ships that came over also had a fiddler. Most of them were just deckhands who also happened to play the fiddle, but some of them were hired for the purpose of playing on the ship.
Ship's fiddler.
Yes. And so it was kind of like a way of keeping spirits high. They would play work songs, but it also meant sometimes as you had passenger ships coming over, you've got the higher gentry dancing with the lower class because on the ship, you know, that's kind of all there was to do. So again, you see this fiddle music kind of breaking down those barriers in certain settings. Certainly not once they arrived. The gentry wouldn't be heard listening to to fiddle music until later.
But after they arrived, where did these fiddlers play? I mean, where were you playing that you got lashed for playing at 9:30 at
well,
night?
Well, pubs, inns, taverns, for sure. So like areas like the Rocks, which we know had a high convict population, and they would, you know, play in the pub and have their evening, and then they would sometimes leave the pub a little too happy and loud, and they would, you know, continue fiddling in the streets, particularly if they'd had – so, like, I've got a report of sealers who had a particularly happy day, and they came out and they fiddled to celebrate the fact that they'd, you know, they'd accomplished a lot that day. But, you know, fiddlers would come out often a bit drunk. They would break people's property sometimes. And so the arrest report would read something like their name, fiddler, did this at this time. This is their punishment, or this is where they'll, you know, we'll reprimand them of some sort. But that also means, you know, when you're relying on these kinds of reports, I'm reading very, very minimal detail about these fiddlers. But the governors, I'm getting all this information. I'm getting so much detail about what they were playing, where they were playing, who they were playing for. But I don't get that kind of insight to the fiddlers. So I was quite conscious not to represent fiddlers as these rowdy rascals. Mm. Although it's, you know, it's interesting. I wanted to make sure that this is also how they're being portrayed, which is quite different, yeah.
But is it safe to assume they weren't playing parlour songs?
I think it's quite safe to assume they weren't, yeah. We have a particular interesting fiddler. Again, he does kind of blur a lot of these boundaries, but he wrote down a lot of the fiddle tunes he was using, and so that a lot of them were kind of Irish and Scottish tunes that they had learned at home, and they were bringing them over and playing them with them. But this particular fiddler, his name is Alexander Lang, and there's also quite a lot of writing about him out there, but he wrote down some original compositions. So he was active in Tasmania. And the interesting thing about the original fiddle tunes that he wrote is that he named them after different people he met throughout Tasmania. And it means we can track his movements as to where he went and who he met. And so that's a really interesting document as well, even though it's all sheet music. I mean, it's hard to know with this stuff. So much of it is guesswork, but it seems he claimed that he was an officer. But the more you dig into it, it seems he may have actually fabricated that. And so it's interesting to think that the violin was kind of this way for him to portray how he wanted to be thought of and remembered. And so he big noted himself a lot in a lot of his writing. He would say, "I, you know, Alexander Lang, Colonel General of this." And, you know, the more we look into it, we're like, not quite. And so there's a big sort of folk revival movement in Tasmania at the moment as well, where they're using a lot of his music and kind of playing these things. But he did also have 60 or more tunes that were Irish, like well-known Irish and Scottish fiddle sort of tunes.
On today's music show, we're talking about the violin in Australia. My guest is Dr. Laura Case, and as you can hear, she is absolutely the full bottle on this subject. Let's talk about professionalism. I mean, beyond the fiddler in the pub who was obviously, you know, hoping to get coins for playing.
Yeah.
When did we get the first evidence of a violinist who is a professional?
Yeah, it's quite well, you know, sort of agreed that the first professional, as we understand it today, violinist was John Philip Dean, and he arrived in the colonies in 1821. He was a really interesting figure as well. You know, there was quite a bit for him to do in the colonies because there wasn't anybody else. Like, he filled a real kind of need.
So he came as a violinist?
He came as a musician. So when they came over and fill in the passenger manifest, they would write their occupation. And he wrote metal worker. But when he's come here, he's established himself as a musician. And so he was one of the first organists in Tasmania when he arrived. He was playing on the first organ to be imported to the colonies. Obviously, he didn't quite get enough money to survive, so he's moved his family up to Sydney. And then in Sydney, he established, you know, he set himself up as a violin teacher, and he was putting advertisements in the paper for himself saying, I can teach your children violin. And he said in the paper that he was a member of the London Philharmonic. Now, we think that he was perhaps just a casual for a year. But again, like in the colonies, no one's going to check that, right?
That's right.
And so it was really this way of sort of establishing himself with this, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? This reputation that, yeah, really, yeah, I find it really interesting to use the violin as a lens to look into the history of these people and what it means.
Yes, yes. So what sort of music did he play and where did he play it?
Yes, it's funny. I mean, he was around for a long time. He was the first, but there were other people who arrived around the same kind of time as him. So William Vincent Wallace was another one, and Joseph Gautreau was another one. And so they kind of arrived around the same-ish sort of time. And there was not a wide appreciation for classical music as we understand it today at this time. John Philip Dean is often referred to as the father of Australian chamber music. He did put on some performances of Beethoven and Weber, but they were not super successful. And it's known that he was limited to few performances of those things because the audiences, they wanted to hear sentimental ballads, airs, glees, this kind of nice music, this parlour style of music. So we're still getting parlour concerts at this time. And we are starting to get a few more things in halls that are popping up. So that's where performances are being held. But it's not like the music that we're hearing in England, for instance.
No, and it's probably worth just pointing out that he arrived in Australia when Beethoven was still alive.
Yes.
So this was actually fairly radical music that he was trying to perform.
Yeah, like some of his performances, it was, you know, some of the first performances of some of these composers. Yeah, you can see that where he was trying to do some of these things, but I think, you know, being in Australia allowed him to establish himself as quite a pioneering musician in a way that he couldn't have in England. So John Dean is, yeah, another interesting character. And William Vincent Wallace, who was around at the same time, he was the first sort of like virtuoso. He was a really good violinist and he was a bit of a rascally character as well, but he was also a composer, so he's most widely known today for his opera Maritana. Which, you know, Australians love to say, oh, we composed part of that in Sydney. We don't think that he actually did. But he would charge quite high amounts at the time for people to come and see him. And he was such a, you know, virtuosic sort of player. And then he left the colony with very high debts. And that was also quite widely reported in the press. But because he was playing these, it was seen as kind of enhancing the culture of the colony. And so he was still very fondly remembered, actually, even though he left with these high debts, which was a big no-no.
And where did they play?
Yes, he was playing in halls and like the Mechanics Hall and just small kind of venues because the theatres didn't pop up until a little bit later, but certainly towards the end. So William Vincent Wallace wasn't actually in Australia for very long. I think it was like 3 years, but John Philip Dean was here for a really long time. And so during his time here, like theatres started to pop up. And so the theatres started to pop up around the 1840s onwards. And so that's when we start to get theatres and then we get orchestras. And then this is a theme that I definitely didn't expect to emerge. And so I was categorising people when I was, you know, looking for my violinists as either amateurs, fiddlers or professionals. But the more I was categorising people as professionals, I realised that there was all these people who were playing solos, and there were also all these people playing in the orchestras, and that's quite different. And so that's when I decided to split those two and look at soloists and then look at orchestral players, because you start to get, again, this break between the types of repertoire. You've got orchestras who are playing at exhibitions. Eventually the musical tastes of the colony started to change. And so we get more serious music being programmed, particularly as the population increased and we get more touring professionals from Europe. It's like Miska Hauser. We start to get these people coming through the colonies and the changing taste, we start to hear more classical music and audiences being more receptive to these things. And so you've got orchestras who are playing classical repertoire, quite serious repertoire, like the Sydney University Music Festival was in the 1850s, I want to say. And, you know, they're playing classical music at this time. But you've also got the circus and you've got comedic performers and you've got this more popular style of music, which was designed to be performed with other activities. So not in total silence where you listen and you have to concentrate because that's, you know, good for the brain and it's intellectually stimulating. Popular music where you might talk while you listen to it, or there might be some dancing or something that happens. And so, and minstrel bands were also really big at this time, which almost always had a violinist in them.
Well, you've mentioned all of these fascinating figures. I can't help noticing none of them is a woman.
Ah, yes.
Why is that?
Well, again, this is also something I didn't know until I started doing this cataloguing. And I was going up to 1860, quite extensively cataloguing everyone. And I was like, my God, there are seriously no women. So started to do some digging. And there was an informal ban on women playing the violin, believe it or not. So this is a hang up from England. It was not the case in all European countries. So Italy and Germany, for instance, women were playing the violin. But England particularly, it was seen as very unfeminine because you're standing on a stage and you have to use quite what was seen as unattractive facial features. And so all these things that were seen as very unfeminine. Women were playing the piano. They were singing. And the guitar was also seen okay because that accentuated the graceful movements of the wrist. But the violin was seen as very unfeminine.
Well, I love the fact that it's to do with facial expression.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've seen some singers who
pull
some pretty funny faces.
Yes, and a lot of conductors were saying, oh, you know, I can't play with these women on the violin because they're so distracting. And yet men had been playing with women who were singers for ages and piano players. And so, yeah, it was this really interesting thing and it was, you know, quite widespread that women weren't playing the violin.
So it's not just professionals that didn't
right.
exist. I mean, even the governor's wives,
yes,
for instance.
No violin for women at that time. But things started to change around 1870. And as soon as that ban was overturned, we've just got so many women playing the violin. So there's just this huge influx of women playing the violin. And that happened kind of between 1870 and 1890. And by 1890, I categorized more women than men playing the violin for the first time. So it happened in a really short time span. But from the 1870s, it was really on for young and old.
Yes. And are we talking, again, all of the different categories that you've talked about,
yeah.
You know, the amateur, the fiddlers, yeah. The professional,
yeah.
the women are everywhere now.
Yeah. Well, I didn't find as many fiddlers. In fact, I don't think I found many women fiddlers at all. I only went up to 1914. but I didn't find many women fiddlers at all. But certainly we start to see women performing as soloists, performing as amateurs, performing in orchestras, and all these kinds of things quite quickly. So particularly through the 1880s and the 1890s, not as much in the 70s here in Australia.
Yes. And do you think perhaps that's because fiddlers tended to play in pubs?
Yeah, I think so. And the style of repertoire, you know, it was it was one thing for a woman to get up and play a nice parlour song on the violin, and I guess it's another thing to be playing in the pub. Definitely that took a lot longer to be widely accepted.
Shall we talk about some of the particular women in your research?
Yeah. One of my favourites, so the first woman to like tour the colonies, her name was Jenny Klaus, and this would have been one of the first times that most people had seen a woman play the violin. And I find it so interesting because all the reports of her tour, they barely mention her gender. The reports give the impression that, you know, it's totally acceptable for women to play the violin now, but a lot of them are very sexualized. You know, lots of reports that say, I can't believe women have had to wait until the last quarter of the century to play the violin. You know, it suits them so well, the tiny little Cremona. It nestles so neatly under her chin, close above her throbbing heart. I kid you not, these are the kinds of reports that are happening.
So it's just flipped, isn't
Total
it?
Total flip, yeah.
Yeah.
That was a really interesting one. And I find it so interesting that she also really faded into obscurity. People don't remember her, but she was the first woman to tour the colonies, and that's really a pioneering thing. She was French. And she went on to tour through Honolulu and the States. So it's interesting that her role in Australian violin culture hasn't really been fully explored or developed just yet.
What about Bessie Doyle?
Poor Bessie. She was one of the first Australian women to really get international success, I guess. So she was performing in Australia. So they would do this thing called benefit concerts, which is when they would do a public concert or put on a public concert and people in the community would donate, and that would be to fund their travels to Europe so that they could go and get an education, because it was widely accepted that you couldn't get a good musical education in Australia. You had to go to Europe. And so she went overseas and she received an amazing education, took all her lessons, and she was touring right through Europe. She came back to Australia and there was a huge hype around her tour in Australia. She went to New Zealand. She performed in Chicago. She performed through the States. She went back to Europe and she performed through Europe. Then she got married. And her husband had to go to South Africa. He was a general of some kind. And so she followed and, you know, kind of stayed on the ship while he did that. Went back to England. And at that point, she'd had a child. And her mother went over and met her. She continued learning and she played. She ended up getting quite a good professorship in America. But there's a period where I can't find anything on her. And the next we find out, I hear about her, is that she had secretly gotten married when she had toured New Zealand. And she wanted to get divorced from this gentleman. And so he said to her, the only way you can get divorced from me, because it wasn't legal in Australia for women to get a divorce at this time, was to go to America. So she went to Dallas and she applied for a divorce. And she thought that that had all gone through. And so that's when she went back to Europe and she got married to somebody else. Turns out that divorce was not legal, apparently. And so the first man she married came to England and said to her, "We're still married and you can never see this other man ever again." And so she respected that and she never saw him again. Then the first man she married died He left her nothing. He donated all his money and all his savings to the Royal National Lifeboat Institute, something like that. And so she was left penniless, with no money or access to all these things. And so the reason I saw this report is because she was going to court trying to claim some of this money. So a very sad end to a really global career, which was crazy at a time where women were, she was not only just playing the violin, she was traveling the world and playing really high-end classical music.
Amazing.
Yeah.
On the music show, I'm talking to Dr. Laura Case about her research, which is about the violin in Australia. We must talk about First Nations violinists.
Yes.
At what point... What's the first evidence that you discovered of a First Nations violin player?
Well, the first sort of accounts are actually just encounters. So we have European people coming to Australia and they're pretty quickly realizing that they can't communicate through language with these people who are here. And so one of the first things they did was play the violin. So one of my favourite accounts is from a French explorer who was on an expedition searching for La Perouse. And they came off and came on shore, this is 1789, and played the violin for some Aboriginal people there who, you know, quickly put their fingers in their ears. They didn't like it at all. And they thought, no, no, that can't be the case. So the fiddler doubled down on his efforts and kept playing. And
play
they,
louder.
Yes, they started screaming. So there's lots of moments like this where Europeans have introduced the violin to Aboriginal people. So this tune is called The Hermit of Killarney. And I thought this might be an interesting one to play because there is an early reference to some Aboriginal musicians playing with some Scottish fiddlers. And so we have this really early record of them kind of playing together in the Windsor area. And all it says was they played a tune named Killarney. So we don't know if this is the exact tune, but my very dear colleague Toby Martin has also done some research into this. And so we thought, well, it might be this tune, but it certainly aligns with the style of repertoire that was being played at this time. And so here is a little bit of The Hermit of Killarney. More widespread accounts of Aboriginal people playing the violin is during the assimilation era. It was often used as a tool for civilization, trying to civilize Aboriginal people on the missions. So they were being forced to learn music. And obviously that's, you know, a very sad part of our history. But it was also, you know, one of the only things that was somewhat enjoyable for a lot of people during that time. So a lot of the First Nations people really enjoyed their music lessons, actually. But I find it interesting what happened as they come off the missions, because a lot of Aboriginal people continued to play the violin and they started to use it much more organically. So around campfires, in corroborees, in bands, and we start to see the violin becoming part of the musical landscape in Aboriginal communities.
That's very interesting. So do we have any evidence of what they played?
Not in the early sort of accounts. I don't have much at all of what they were playing, unfortunately. There are pictures. There are pictures from the missions and there are pictures of some really early Aboriginal bands and they say, oh, you know, the accounts might say, oh, they played the violins in a corroboree. Sometimes there were missionaries who would put on events or shows to demonstrate the good work that they've been doing. And at that point, they would get an Aboriginal person to play the violin and they would have a gum leaf. And so that time they were mostly playing hymns and spirituals. That's what they were being taught on the missions and kind of demonstrating to people. But the Cape Barren Fiddlers are a very interesting group of two Aboriginal men from Cape Barren Island near Tasmania. And we do know that they were playing some fiddle music. And there's some recordings from the 1960s or 1970s. So we're talking a much later period here. But they were descendant, I believe, from sealers in that area. And so they've got this interesting sort of mix of things that they're bringing into this repertoire that they're playing. And this is a traditional tune, Irish tune. It's called The Black Cat Piddled in the White Cat's Eye. but we do know that they were playing this one because we have recordings of it. So this is how this one goes.
Can we mention specific names again here?
Sure. So one of the first violinists that I looked at, Aboriginal violinist, was Peter Jetta. He was active in Western Australia. He was on the New Norcia mission. We don't have a lot of details about him, but he was born, we presume, between kind of 1870 sort of time. We have pictures of him on the mission, and we know that he took the violin off the mission and was playing around campfires and things like that with community. And his great-grandson is Phil Wally Stack, who is quite a famous Aboriginal didgeridoo player. So it's really great to see, you know, that follow-through of cultural continuation and music making still happening. Like, that legacy lives here today.
And how do we know about Peter Jetta?
I found some reports of him in some old newspapers because, you know, high-end officials would often go to the missions to see the good work they were doing. They would take photos, they would put it in the paper. So I have those accounts. Of course, there are also archives. And so I've been through quite a lot of archives to kind of access a lot of these things. I didn't expect there to be such a rich history, again, with the violin in First Nations communities, but there really is. And I think because the violin is made from natural resources, you know, it's made from wood, it's made from things you can find all around you. And that is traditionally how Aboriginal people have made music. And so I think that really aligns with the effects of traditional music making. And it does sound, you know, the violin sound, it's regularly compared to the human voice. It's often also compared to the gum leaf. Gumleaf entered Aboriginal repertoire at a later stage, but they go together quite well. And so I think all of these things kind of ensured a really easy, is not the right word, but a transition into the music that was being made.
You're talking about the violin being made from things that are lying around. What do we know about the first violins that were made here? When did that happen?
Yeah, there was some really interesting violin makers. And there is actually, I found lots of reports of Aboriginal people making violins from the materials they had around them. Bush timber, kerosene tins, chocolate boxes, all kinds of things. So there were actually violin makers who arrived in the early colony as well. And one of my favourites is John Devereux. And he came from England and was like, oh, it's so hot here. How am I going to make violins that can, you know, survive in the Australian climate? And so he would build his violins with this, what he called a tension bar that ran all the way along the top of the violin to stop it, what he thought, from warping in the heat. So I think it's quite interesting to see how violin makers have also adapted their practice to this new environment, which was fundamentally foreign to them.
Well, they'd have to, wouldn't they?
Yeah. But I've played on one John Devereux violin and it just makes it sound very dense, very, very, no resonance because it's so heavy having all that timber. Like, the violin needs to be quite light.
I know your research cuts off at 1914. But if you don't mind, I'd like to sort of jump another 110 years into the future and talk about the present and to talk about, maybe we should talk about Eric Avery, because he's a good example of an Indigenous violin player
and
composer.
Yeah.
And do you, when you hear him play, does your research sort of inform the way you listen to him?
Certainly it does. And also my own personal story and background, you know, being an Indigenous violinist myself, I grew up learning classical music, and I didn't understand that there was another way, I think, that I could connect with this. And so hearing Eric, I think, is so inspiring to me, because he brings those two things together so beautifully. He plays the violin, but it is such a clear representation of his indigeneity and his heritage. And so there are often comments sort of floating around, you know, that like, oh, well, playing the violin is evidence that assimilation was successful, right? Because you're playing this European instrument and not your own traditional music. But I think reframing it to say, well, where this is what we have access to, we can actually express our indigeneity in a really powerful way. And so I think Eric is just a perfect and beautiful example of that. His music is just gorgeous. You can't help but just croon when you hear Eric play. He just has the perfect way of putting it, you know. I'd love to live in his brain for a day and just see this process of the way he puts it all out is just absolutely beautiful.
Dr. Laura Case, thank you very much for being on The Music Show.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was the end of Eric Avery's Biermanger Juxtaposed, and my thanks again to Dr. Laura Case. This episode was first aired in January 2025, and since we recorded it, Laura's put out a book. It's called A Socio-Cultural History of the Violin in Australia, Identity, Resilience and Colonial Legacy, and it's published by Routledge. The music show is produced by C. Benedict and Ellie Parnell, technical production by Nathan Turnbull. We're all on Gadigal land. Next time on the music show, as part of our Best of the Year programming, Steve Jones, the guitarist of the Sex Pistols, on why we're still talking about the band 50 years on, particularly since they only ever put out one studio album, and the Scots folk singer Quiney, who collected songs while travelling across Argyll on her horse for her album Four Folk Mind Me. Here's a little sample.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.